it's just a hugely complex issue, not just because the lifetime allowance is being abolished, but because also two new allowances are being introduced partly in this place. And one of them, the one that family lawyers need to be aware of, is the new lump sum allowance.
I liken the lifetime allowance on £1,073,000 a bit like Freddy Krueger on that film in the 80s, A Nightmare on Elm Street. Just when you think that it's gone away, it comes back again and jumps out of a manhole, and it's still coming at you again.
Hello, and welcome to the Resolution Podcast. This month, we are joined by Hilary Woodward, Rhys Taylor, and Paul Cobley to discuss pensions on divorce, of course, and the recent PAG 2 guide. Before we get going with our pensions questions, I'd ask you each to introduce yourself and tell us about your interest in pensions. Hilary, would you mind going first?
Yes. Well, I worked as a family solicitor and mediator in London and Bristol for about 20 odd years, specialising in cohabitation and pensions. And then for the last 20 years or so, I've been working in socio-legal research with Bristol, Cardiff, Cambridge, Exeter, and now Bristol. And I'm currently an honorary senior research fellow at Bristol School of Law, and also known for my sins as the CEO of PAG, Pension Advisory Group.
Hi, I'm Paul Cobley. I'm a financial planner and director of Oak Barn Financial Planning, based in Godalming in Surrey. I'm a member of the Pension Advisory Group and the Pensions, Tax and Financial Remedy Committee.
Hello, my name's Rhys Taylor. I'm a family law barrister specialising in financial remedies, practising out of the 36 Group. Back in about 2014, 2015, Hilary Woodward phoned me up one afternoon and asked me if I'd help her with a talk about pensions, and a lot followed from that conversation.
Thanks, everybody. So the reason we've reconvened, this is the second podcast on this topic, is because the rather wonderful Pension Advisory Group report has been updated. What is it that made you feel it was time for a second edition? Hilary, perhaps.
So the first guide was published in 2019, and even at the launch, one of our co-chairs suggested we should probably review it after a few years. And there have been a few changes, obviously the Divorce and Separation Act, Brexit, and quite a lot of other things. And the whole time since 2019, I've kept a record of all the feedback that we've had on the report. We've encouraged feedback, and we have conducted several consultations to find out how useful the guide has been, if people agreed or disagreed strongly with anything, and if they wanted more guidance on any particular areas. And we've very much used all that feedback and the responses to the consultation as the basis of a refresh of the PAG 1 guide.
Are you able to tell us broadly what has changed in PAG 2?
I can say, first of all, that on the webpage, there is now a fairly detailed part-by-part list of the changes, which is very useful. There's also been a blog, which Rhys and I did, on the Financial Remedies Journal. And in the resolution review, Philip Way and Sarah Hoskinson have done a short article about the changes. The changes of some of the things I mentioned earlier, the Divorce and Separation Act, Brexit, the lifetime allowance. There have been developments in case law, some of which have referred to the guide. There have been the Galbraith tables, MacLeod. So quite a few things which we needed to include, plus the general refresh and expanded explanation of the points that people were particularly keen to hear more about.
I think it's fair to say, Hilary, that there are a couple of amendments needed to be made as well, a couple of errors that slipped into the first version. And also we've had changes to pension law as well, for instance, the lifetime allowance. I mean, that was fully drafted and virtually gone off to the publishers when completely revamped the whole chapter. So,
There's also been a tightening up of some aspects of the report. So, for instance, in the first report, it was said that PAG in some way was encouraging the equal division of pensions after a short marriage. At least that was a criticism I'd heard from a few quarters. And we didn't think we'd ever said that. We always thought we'd said that Section 25 was king and that you had to look at all the circumstances of the case, including the length of the marriage. But we've been perceived as being saying something slightly unusual about short marriages. And so we took the opportunity to tighten that up in particular.
Thanks, everyone. So one of the changes that's come about since the first report that Hilary referred to briefly there is the advent of the Galbraith tables. Are you able to explain to us what those are and how they work and how they can be a useful tool for practitioners?
Just to give the background very briefly, towards the end of PAG 1 back in 2019, the committee thought it would be a great idea if there were a set of tables to work a little bit like the Duxbury tables, but to be pension context specific, that would help people value the gross value of a defined benefit pension. But in order to do that, we could see that it was a significant piece of work. And quite frankly, we'd all done enough by then. And so we just had an appendix in PAG 1 saying that wouldn't this be a helpful thing to have if someone was willing to give it some thought. And Jonathan Galbraith of Matheson Consulting came forward a couple of years later having done that. And the essential idea of the Galbraith tables is to allow you to value the gross value of a defined benefit pension other than by reference to the cash equivalent. You look at the person's age and you look at the benefit that they will receive from a particular point in the future in order to arrive at a multiplier, which you then can work out a gross value. They have a cautious welcome by the PAG 2. They are described as a useful starting point. And so far as the assumptions behind them, Jonathan Galbraith doesn't say that they are right in all circumstances. What he says is that essentially, to borrow from another context, they're a tool, not a rule. But if you don't have the benefit of a pension expert and you want to just orientate yourself as to the kind of parish you might be in respect of valuing the gross value of a defined benefit pension, that's a first port of call. The typical context in which they'd be used is for offsetting, trying to work out how you trade your apples and your pears. And once you have the gross value, of course, you've got to make an adjustment for tax. And then also there's a further adjustment that the Pension Advisory Group talks about. In some circumstances, it may be appropriate for there to be an adjustment in respect of utility, the benefit of having jam now rather than jam later. So it's a very, very narrow and specific thing that the Galbraith tables do, which is to, as I've said several times, give you a gross value of a defined benefit pension. They have found their way into at a glance. And so that gives you some view about how they're viewed by the authors of that particular publication. There's yet to be a high-level judicial treatment of them, endorsing them, as it were, as being something that can be used in cases generally. And I would have thought that the general space in which they're going to be used is in pre-application, trying to work out what have we got here, using in dispute resolution and mediation, and quite possibly up to and including FDRs. But I wouldn't have thought at this stage they've evolved far enough yet to be used at a final hearing. There was a case a few months ago where His Honour Judge Hess was dealing with a capitalisation, and a question arose about the valuation of a defined benefit pension. And an expert was instructed in order to deal with that. And we took the opportunity to run the Galbraith table rule over that valuation. And it was interesting to see that the Galbraith tables came out at about 10% different to the expert valuation. Now, of course, there's no saying that necessarily the expert was correct, or indeed that Jonathan Galbraith was correct. No, that was the difference between them. And I'm just flagging that to highlight that in some instances, something like a 10% difference is unacceptable to people. But in many instances, particularly in the financial remedy context, we do paint with a broad brush and valuations are fragile. We all accept that the value of assets can go up and down. And so sometimes people might say, well, and that kind of valuation difference is not material for what is required when dealing with a financial remedy settlement. And I should mention finally, before I think Paul's going to tell us a little bit about how they actually work, is that when they were first published, and that was before the war in Ukraine, for the advent of Liz Truss, to calamities that have been visited upon us. And so the markets have changed since then. And I know that it's the intention of Jonathan Galbraith to update the tables so that they refresh and they stay relevant. And so the current tables are based on assumptions from a couple of years back. And we await the new tables, which will come out in the next At a Glance.
Thank you, Rhys. Well, I was going to comment, but I think you've stolen most of my material. So the important thing to understand about these tables, as Rhys says, is that they're designed to put a capital value a pension capital value on defined benefit schemes. And so it's really important to understand that they're intended for defined benefit schemes and not for defined contribution schemes. So we know that in the vast majority of cases with defined contribution schemes, if you're looking at a pension fund of £100,000, then we know it's worth £100,000. There will be things like market value adjusters, where you've got an old with profits fund, or where you've got guaranteed annuity rates or guaranteed pensions, all different forms of guarantees, where the defined contribution fund isn't perhaps the correct value to use. But there are relative minority cases. So what we're trying to do, or what Jonathan is trying to do with these tables, is to try and give you a method of turning or working out what the true value or fair value, and there's lots of different ways of calling this, and you'll never find two actuaries that agree on the terminology for this, but we tend to refer it to as fair value or replacement value of a defined benefit scheme. So we can then assess whether the transfer value is poor or fair or good value. So what these tables are trying to do is to create something that looks like what is known as the defined contribution fund equivalent. In other words, to convert it into something that looks like that defined contribution fund value that we can rely upon. And as Rhys says, you know, these tables were produced a couple of years ago. You just need to look and see what's happened to the UK government bond markets, which are a major influencer of transfer values, of annuity rates, to see that I think these tables need refreshing. There's been quite a lot of movement in the bond markets. Transfer values have decreased significantly over the last couple of years. But as and when they get refreshed, then I think, you know, for a while they will be a reliable indicator again. But it comes with quite a few warnings, and you can read all about those warnings in paragraph, I think it's 7.24 of the PAG guide. But for me, the most important part of using these tables, or the biggest risk warning, is about your starting point. Because a lot of people have got, apart from those people who are active in their final salary schemes, and they tend to be quite a small minority, most of the pensions that practitioners will be dealing with will be deferred pensioners, people who've left their companies, left their pension schemes, and they've got a deferred pension from maybe 3 years ago, 10 years ago, or even back, you know, back to the 90s. And it's really important that when you're starting, using the starting point, the income as the starting point, it has to be the revalued income. So you have to take, so if someone had a pension at date of leaving, let's say in 1995, of 3,000 a year, that is not the figure to use. You need to revalue that pension of 3,000 a year in line with the relevant rates of inflation up until the present day. And I can't think there is a single family law practitioner, and probably few IFAs apart from people who deal with transfers, who can do that calculation. It's much easier to get the scheme to do it for you. So the really important thing is, if you're looking at a statement and it says this is the pension at date of leaving, then you need to apply back to the pension scheme and you need to ask them for the current revalued pension, because that's your starting point to then multiply by the multiplicand in the tables.
Just on Paul's last point, I heard one financial advisor describe the Galbraith tables as like a defibrillator, and they could save your life, but in the wrong hands, they could kill someone.
Rhys, we've all had experience of cases where either the parties or an unhelpful judge at a first appointment tells us that pension report is unaffordable or not the right thing in this particular situation. Is there any safe way for practitioners to approach offsetting of pensions where there aren't the funds for a POD report?
Well, quite often pensions are just one part of the overall jigsaw. And I think the key to understanding the overall jigsaw and removing the fear from dealing with pensions on divorce is to ask yourself, do I have a broad handle on what the gross value of this pension is worth? And the Galbraith tables are one way of doing that. And so you may, if you are able to answer that question, then you might be in a position to be able to say, well, I know that this is worth, about £500,000, and I know the house is worth about £400,000, and I'm going to approach the case with the financial remedy broad brush accordingly. And so I think one of the problems with pensions is because, quite frankly, lawyers are often quite scared of the maths and are quite scared of the pension uncertainties and the technicalities with pensions, is that they've become terrified into thinking that everything's got to be calculated down to two decimal points. And that's just not how the rest of financial remedies law works. And we all know that, quite often it's a needs must kind of outcome in those lower value cases. And so there will be many instances where you could proceed without a POD report for offsetting. But you need to be constantly asking yourself, have I got handle on what the gross value of this pension is before I start trading it with other assets? And if you haven't, then you probably need to reach out for some help.
Just to add to that, Rhys, I agree. I remember George Matheson saying at a seminar we both spoke at many years ago that the average case he's dealing with when they're defending lawyers who are having claims against them for offsetting, that the average case is around about 50,000. So they're quite low numbers. And maybe lawyers need to say to the judge where these reports are being refused that they're exposing the lawyers to potential litigation if someone can't actually help them with determining what the correct value is. And just to go back to what we were saying earlier, it is for defined benefit schemes that we're using these Galbraith tables, not defined contribution schemes. So there is a little bit more definition as to and description of how to do the tax calculations that Rhys referred to earlier. So that's been updated and enhanced. But in many cases, if it's a defined contribution scheme, you can simply knock off 15% and you'll get the net of tax figure to be using for offsetting. So even if you just do that basic calculation for defined contribution schemes, it's not going to be far off what an expert is going to be doing anyway. And doing that would be better than doing nothing.
I know that we're going to talk about the Fair Shares report in a moment, but one of the really interesting things that comes out of that is how little pensions get taken into account, how nervous people are about them. and how they somehow regard them as the unassailable property of the person who accumulated them. But aside from those issues, another very interesting point that comes out of it is that in the low value cases, and the Fairshares report makes fairly depressing reading for how broke everybody seems to be, it is that pragmatic decisions need to be made about generally housing children. And so many financial settlements which are affected without the assistance of lawyers, expensive or otherwise, are simply pragmatic decisions that don't really bear any relation to the law. She's going to keep the house because she's got to keep a roof over the children's heads, and so he gets to keep his pension. It's offsetting, but there's absolutely no maths or science to it whatsoever, and it's fairly rough justice for one or both of them.
All right. Let's talk a bit about what was said in the Fair Shares report, where actually I was looking at it earlier. There are loads of comments in there about pensions, much of which you must have felt endorsed some of the things you have been saying over these two reports. So that must have been good to hear. But one thing that did come out is exactly the comment Rhys made, that individuals, and I'm not talking necessarily about lawyers, although I think there probably are still some lawyers with this view as well, but individuals do seem to report that they see pensions to be the property of the person that generated it rather than property of the marriage. Now, in needs cases, PAG tells us, and I think this is consistent for both reports, that the timing and the source of pensions assets is not generally a relevant consideration. So there seems to be a dispute between what PAG suggests and what maybe the man on the street thinks. And I wondered whether you wanted to come back on that. Why is it, Hilary, that you're saying something different to the man on the street?
From my own research, I'm aware that popular sense of justice means that you share pensions that were accrued during the marriage and not ones which were accrued outside. And it's obviously the whole issue of needs, the needs of the children and the needs of the parents first to consider, regardless of when the pension was accrued. But I do think it is quite significant. The apportionment was the biggest, by far, issue that people wanted more guidance on. And I think that does reflect the fact that their client's sense of justice is that either they shouldn't be dealt with at all, they're not that interested in them, or that they should just stay with the person whose name they're in.
Actually, I thought that the Fair Shares report makes for fairly grim satisfaction for those who are concerned about the plight of people who need pension justice on divorce. And it's rather depressing that we've been banging on about this for many years, and there's still a huge amount of misunderstanding about how pensions should be dealt with. I think there's two boxes into which pensions get put. They get put into the too complicated emotionally. Oh, he's going after, oh, she's going after his pension. And what a hostile and awful thing to be doing. What a low blow. And then also too technically complicated, not really understanding that sometimes the huge value of that pension. And so there's I think, emotional confusion and technical confusion, which comes about with pensions on divorce. Interestingly, the Law Commission, when going around doing consultations, have as one of their questions, certainly in the consultations I've attended, what do you think should change about pensions? And with my various different hats on, I've had the privilege to speak to them two or three times now, and I make the same point every time. And I go to section 25(2)(h) of the Act, and it says this: in the case of proceedings for divorce or nullity of marriage, the value to each of the parties to the marriage of any benefit which, by reason of the dissolution or annulment of the marriage, that party will lose a chance of acquiring. Now, I've been in this job 27 years, and I'm still not totally convinced I know what that subsection is getting at. So pity help the man on the Clapham omnibus. And my point to the Law Commission is that it should say, front and square, must take pensions into account. And then that might deal with some of the emotional warfare that goes on in this space.
We know that divorced women are some of the most financially vulnerable on retirement, don't we? So for me, that would be an indicator that we haven't been getting it right in the past in how we deal with pensions.
Is apportionment ever appropriate? I know it's difficult. Is that the only reason for steering clear of it?
No, apportionment is appropriate in some cases. And so in those cases where there's pots of money and no one is ever at risk of not having enough to live on, then of course it's right, according to just the general authorities, that you approach cases on a sharing basis and you ask yourself, well, what can be scythed out as being non-matrimonial, and the claimant spouse doesn't have a right to a share in that unless they can demonstrate their needs for it. But the situation with pensions, particularly in the middle money case, is quite difficult because the pension figures can look quite big. Ooh, there's £1 million pension. And people might say, well, that's a lot of money, isn't it? But rather depressingly, if you look at how much £1 million is going to produce over the course of your retirement, you'll feel fairly bleak about things. And so the capital values of these pensions might look quite high and might encourage particularly the holder of the pension in a middle money case to say, ah, this is a sharing case. Whereas in fact, the claimant spouse side need to be sure that the tribunal they're appearing before understands what the needs consequences are of the division. And that is why so often one looks to the income outcome to see how it is actually going to affect people in their retirements. And so, yes, of course, in the big money cases, pension apportionment is appropriate. But the lower down you come in the wealth scales, arguably, the less appropriate it becomes. But there's always those quirky cases, aren't there? And I can think of a case where somebody, a wife, was in her late 50s and had been married for a very short period of time. 18 months or 2 years, and all of his pension, and he was in his 60s, had been acquired prior to their being together, and no one is sensibly saying that someone in those circumstances would ordinarily get a substantial pension share. It brings us back to section 25 and the importance of being able to apply discretion.
Well, that just brings us back round to considering the approach to pensions in short marriage cases.
But it's difficult, isn't it? At what point does it bite? So you can say for the person who's been married for a year, well, obviously that isn't going to bite. But, you know, what do we call a short marriage these days? Is it 5 years? Is it 7 years? I heard someone the other day say, oh, no, 7 years isn't a short marriage these days. And so, you know, if he's been contributing for 14 years and they've been together 10 years and they've got children and she's left the workplace during that period of time, then all of a sudden the question becomes much thornier and perhaps the length of the marriage less important.
Yeah, well, there's a plethora of authorities giving many different timescales, aren't there, for short marriages.
The other thing you just touched on there, Rhys, is this issue, which is now plastered all over the new PAG 2 guidance, which is the seamless cohabitation to marriage, because it could be a 5-year marriage. But if you've got 10 years cohab before that, you've got a 15-year marriage. And I have to say, it was something I was completely aware of as a non-lawyer when we did the PAG 1 guidance. And you will now find that literally, as I say, plastered all over the guide, that it's there is a lot of case law authority, as I understand it, that points to seamless cohabitation, to marriage being the period that you should be taking if you are apportioning, and not the period of actual marriage itself.
It's always been a curious thing with pensions. Pension practice on divorce has so many weird quirks. And one of them is that in all other circumstances, we take the period of seamless cohabitation. Yet when it comes to divorce, that additional question is asked of the expert to try and, screw the pension share down a little bit tighter.
So moving on from that, one of the other really significant changes since the first PAG report is the abolition of the lifetime allowance. And I think the first report spent a lot of time covering that. What are your feelings generally? Is that a change that's staying with us? And if so, what are the consequences? Or do we need to expect it to come back?
I think I'll touch on this one. Whether it comes back is a matter for speculation. And I have to say, having had some insight into the amount of work that HMRC is doing to get rid of it, it's just the most monumental task you can possibly imagine. Where we're currently at is that the Finance Act has been passed through the First House. It's gone to the Lords. HMRC already knows that there are errors and omissions in the Act itself, and specific paragraphs have had to be inserted to allow for statutory legislation, secondary legislation, to make those amendments and to add the additional information that's going to be required. It's just a hugely complex issue, not just because the lifetime allowance is being abolished, but because also two new allowances are being introduced partly in its place. And one of them, the one that family lawyers need to be aware of, is the new lump sum allowance. So since the 6th of April last year, people have still been tested against the lifetime allowance, but the lifetime allowance charge has been 0% or zero. So the effect is as if it has been abolished. From the 6th of April this year, 2024, it will be abolished. But from the 6th of April, people will then be tested against this new lump sum allowance, which is really, really complicated in itself. You'd think it was straightforward. Where family lawyers do need to be aware of what's going on is partly relating to the lifetime allowance itself. So over the years, people have been able to protect themselves against higher lifetime allowances. So back in 2006, there was the enhanced protection and primary protection. And then in line with legislation at the time, the lifetime allowance went up to 1.8 million. And then gradually since 2012, it's been reducing. And so protections have been available at 2012, 2014, 2016. Some of these protections, the individual protections in 14 and 16, have been affected. The individual protections can be lost on divorce. And you might well say, well, if the lifetime allowance is being abolished, then we don't need to worry about it anymore. Well, you do, because where people have got these protections, this is going to, not only did the protection in 2012 give someone a lifetime allowance of 1.8 million, but it also gave them an enhanced lump sum of 25% of that, so 450,000. And that factor, that enhancement, is going to continue under the new regime with the lump sum allowance. So even though the lifetime allowance is gone, you'll still need your 2012 fixed protection certificate to prove that you've got 450,000 of protected lump sum when it comes to offset against the lump sum allowance. That's the simple story. There are all sorts of transitional protections coming in, some of which from a meeting I was attending a week or two ago, I'm not sure even HMRC can answer them at the moment. They've introduced yet again, which I just find staggering. And of course, they have to follow government policy, but they've introduced yet again another tier of complexity. So just as we thought the lifetime allowance would go and things would become simple, they've actually become more complicated.
I liken the lifetime allowance and the £1,073,000 a bit like Freddy Krueger from that film in the 80s, A Nightmare on Elm Street. Just when you think that it's gone away, it comes back again and jumps out of a manhole, and it's still coming at you again.
Well, for people that have got the standard lifetime allowance currently, that 1,073,100, and who knows why the 100 crept in. It was supposed to be rounded down. I think HMRC just wanted to prove everyone wrong who'd been speculating, because they knew the formula that that's what it was going to be. They just thought they'd sort of throw them a curveball at the last minute. But the new lump sum allowance is actually 25% of 1,073,100. So people, I think, I'm sure in years to come will say, where the hell did that figure come from? But I think it was someone's idea of a joke some years back. The one thing that you still need to do as family lawyers in the future is you need to continue to ask people where you see that they've got significant pensions. You need to ask if they've got any lifetime allowance protection.
Okay.
Because it will impact. And if you've got someone who's, let's say, got £2 million of pension fund, and they've got lifetime allowance protection at 1.8 million, and you've got someone who hasn't got, well, it's probably someone with 3 million of pension fund and someone with lifetime allowance protection of 1.8 million, they will still keep that protection. If it's fixed protection 2012, they will still keep that following the divorce. And so if you split that pension and the wife's got nothing, you split that pension, they've got 1.5 million each. The wife has got a lump sum, which is capped at 25% of the 1,073,100. And the husband has got a lump sum that's capped at 1.5 million, which is his remaining fund after it's been split down the middle, because he's still got the protected lifetime allowance enhancement factor. So that gives the husband an advantage. And that's a case where you'd probably need to get an expert involved, because the husband has got a tax-free cash advantage.
Okay, so still creating headaches for us all then. Okay, worth knowing. Thank you.
And the thought, Anita, that the Labour is going to bring that back if they get elected at the next general election. I don't think HMRC would ever forgive them if they did that.
Well, we'll just have to watch this space and see, won't we? Okay, so the other thing that I genuinely get emailed about or see questions about on you know, emails and WhatsApp groups is what on earth you should do when there's an age gap between the parties. So what I would like to call an age gap case, but what you PAG people would refer to as an age differential and income gap case. So I was wondering whether in the updated guide you have come up with any other solutions for that conundrum as opposed to what you had in the first guide. Paul?
Well, the answer is yes, we have. And there are four new suggestions, one of which I'm a little surprised we didn't have in the first guide, which is the judicial separation. The other methods that we've included are spousal maintenance, an increased percentage pension sharing order, and consecutive orders, where we go from, a pension attachment order to a pension sharing order. What I would say is that none of these are perfect solutions. For me, the judicial separation is the obvious no-brainer. It just enables people to continue without getting divorced, and at the point they get the divorce, then they do the pension share. Unfortunately, because people are usually getting divorced for a reason, when I suggest this to people, most people don't want to entertain the idea. So it's a real problem, but it's one we have to deal with. And other than that, there are no real perfect solutions. And we just have to go through the options with people and try and find a way that works.
Well, you didn't nail your colours to the mast. What about you, Rhys? Are you going to nail your colours to the mast as to which one we should be looking at?
Well, it is difficult, and you can have the chickens come home to roost, for instance, with judicial separation, fine at the point of separation, but 3, 4, 5 years down the line, one of them is getting remarried or wants to get married, and then it's very difficult indeed. And while that's not what we agreed back in the day, I would never have agreed to the other things if I knew this was going to happen. Interestingly enough, the PAG report does say that a deferred pension sharing order is technically possible, although in most instances ill-advised. And so lots of people think you can't have a deferred pension sharing order. The considered view of the committee is that the legislation does allow for it, but that if you were doing so, you would need a very thorough attendance note explaining the risks to your client. It would probably need to be covered off with some insurance. Back in the day when I started at the bar 27 years ago, there were books on pensions on divorce and insurance. And you'd have to make sure that the risk of death was covered off by insurance. And so, and also probably some form of injunction or undertaking that someone wouldn't deal with or draw down or otherwise spirit away the money in the pension which is being dealt with. And so there would need to be a very high degree of trust in those circumstances to allow that to happen, but technically possible. But we say it to be deployed in the rarest of cases.
I think, to be clear though, Rhys, where we were talking, when I was talking about judicial separation, I was talking in the context of the intention to move to divorce once the person who is currently unable to receive their pension could actually do so. So in the same way that we talk about going from pension attachment orders to pension sharing, which I have seen done and been involved with, it would be running alongside that judicial separation, going to divorce, and the two would change at the same time. And so I think there'd have to be a clear understanding by both parties that if they go down that route, then neither party, it doesn't stop anyone getting into a relationship, as far as I'm aware, but it means that they just understand that they can't remarry until they reach that key point. And it's a fairly straightforward, I don't know, from judicial separation to divorce, I guess it's the same process. But where it gives people protection is that the big danger of people dying before the pension sharing order can take effect is effectively removed in the vast majority of cases, and I'll come back to that in a moment, because they can then benefit from the spouse's pension. If you've got a defined benefit scheme, for example, involved here, they can benefit from the spouse's pension on death because they're still separate, they're only separated and not divorced. Where you do need to be careful, though, and this is a huge warning, and it applies to at least one of the public sector schemes. I can't quite recall off the top of my head which one it is. It might be the firefighters, not sure. Is where people are separated. If you've been separated, say, for more than a year or two, then that would automatically preclude you from getting the spouse's pension. So you do need to do that check first.
Okay, so the answer is it's tricky, huh? Who'd have guessed? Another thing that is tricky is what is referred to as moving target syndrome. Is that something that you come across in practice? Do you want to tell us what it is, what the dangers are, and what we need to be looking out for?
Yeah, happy to cover that one. So I would say moving target syndrome applies in every single pension and divorce case. So you have the value that you're working on during the divorce negotiations, and then you have the value that eventually lands in the recipient's pension pot at the point of implementation. And you've never got any idea what that's going to be, apart from where the pension scheme might have advised the client, the recipient, that they've now started the implementation period, and this is broadly the value that is going to be transferred. That gives you some indicator. But especially if you're dealing with defined benefit schemes, and if we look at what's happened to transfer values just over the couple of years since the invasion of Ukraine and the global inflation crisis that caused, if I'm looking at, let's say, a valuation of 400,000 from late 2021, early 2022, I'm expecting that to reduce by a significant amount. And all you can say to the client, and it's really important that lawyers are alight to this issue and actually point out to their clients that you've got no idea what you'll actually receive. If you think you're going to get 50% of 400,000, that just ain't going to happen. It's just ain't going to happen. You might get 200, but you might get 150, or you might even get 100. And what we've seen in the 20 odd years that I've been doing pensions and divorce, we've really seen UK government bond yields gradually decline over that period as interest rates and inflation has declined. And so typically, for much of that period, we've seen transfer values going up. So the recipients have usually been delighted. And again, I'm talking mostly about defined benefit schemes here, with defined contribution schemes, it's reasonably predictable, what depending on what the markets are doing, roughly what they might get. But with defined benefit schemes, I might have seen someone expecting to get 200,000 and they get 350 or 400 and they're absolutely delighted. And that's been the case for many a year, but it hasn't been the case for the last 2 years. And just in this last week, I've had a husband, I actually acted for this couple jointly, and the husband had noted that she got 150 instead of he was expecting her to get about 250. And he emailed me to say, is it worth challenging the scheme because she's lost out on this? And that's a first. I've had a lot of angry husbands contact me over the years to say, why has she got more? And, you know, if we'd have known it was going to be more, we'd have had a different outcome in the expert's report. Well, but you didn't know. And that's the problem. And the longer it takes to implement the order, the changes in economic factors over the period before the implementation, all of these can impact on the values. So I think the key thing, the key learning point for lawyers here is always, always, always point out to your client, if they're going to be the recipient of a pension share, it's going to be a different amount to what we've got on the paper right now. And we don't know whether it's going to be higher or lower, but it will be one of the two.
And is the economic climate such that people need to update pension reports? I mean, if you get a pension report before an FDR doesn't settle at the FDR and you're then 8 months later at a final hearing, are people needing to update their reports in those situations? Because that's another expense, isn't it?
Yes, often, particularly for public sector pensions at the minute, because of the McLeod remedy, and public sector pensions are now being calculated in a different way since the 1st of October 2023. And rather unhelpfully, different public sector pensions are introducing the McLeod remedy at a different pace and in different ways. And so it's a wonderfully confused picture out there, but certainly there's a need to update there. And then with the change in bond markets, I've seen cases sort of pre-trust and post-trust have £200,000 difference in the cash equivalent and very much needed to update. Could I also just mention something, a techie little point, which will be relevant to many people. A pension sharing order becomes effective, you will know, on the later of the decree absolute or 28 days after the making of the order. And in fact, the 28 days is the time for appealing, which is currently 21 days, and a statutory 7 days. That's how you get to the 28 days. But it's after the order has been made. And there can be difficulties of timing where you have a private FDR and everyone thinks they've made a decision. You could have had a private FDR just before the Queen died. And then there's some faffing around with the drafting of the order. It takes a while. Eventually, it goes into court, 4 or 6 weeks later, by which time Liz Truss has done her worst. And all of a sudden, the value of the pension has changed really significantly. And so you do need to bear in mind in the private FDR context that it is the date of the order, not the date of the decision at the private FDR. It's an obvious point, really, but it can make for quirky outcomes in some cases. I should also mention for people who really want to dive deep into all of this, Paul and I and Michael Horton a couple of years back wrote an article in Family Law Journal on issues to do with protecting the pension share and the sort of grey zone of, you know, what's the status of them after they're made and before they're in the bag. And one of the other complications about the current legislation is arguably that we shouldn't be running the date from the date of the order, we should be running the effective day from the date of the decision made by the court. And the date of the decision and the date of the sealing of an order in court can be different. And that rule change came about when the family procedure rules were brought in back in 2012. And that, again, makes for a slightly difficult question, particularly when people die at inconvenient moments. I'm afraid I have a little niche practice of people dying at inconvenient moments with having been the recipient of a pension sharing order and what's the status of it. And they do make for fascinatingly complex questions.
Drawing all of this to a close then, what has been the feedback about PAG, Hilary?
From the feedback we had, it was on the whole, it was very positive that people really valued having the freely accessible source of information and guidance. And if there were criticisms, they tended to be constructive, and we have tried to address them in PAG 2. So, I mean, ultimately, we were just hoping that we would get fairer and more consistent judgments or settlements as a result of this, where it involves pensions, and very much geared towards the, not the big money cases, but the everyday cases that most people are dealing with most of the time, just to try and help people through that minefield of issues. That's what I would hope. We are in discussion, interestingly, with the Ministry of Justice about their statistics, which we have cast doubts about the number of pension orders which they say have been made. And it'll be interesting to see if we can get some more reliable statistics about the number of orders which are made.
An interesting feature of the statistics is that they would have it that there's a brisk trade in pension attachment orders. And that just can't be right. They're being misposted in some way.
Yes.
Hilary's mentioned a couple of times the survival guide, and I'd just like to put that front and centre before we close this afternoon. A charity called Law for Life Advice Now provide a suite of guides for people who can't afford legal representation. And they really are tremendous documents. And what Law for Life have done is they've taken the PAG report, carefully read it, digested it, and written it in language which is accessible to a layperson. And that is available free online. You want to buy yourself a hard copy, it's at an affordable price, less than £20. And that is a tremendous resource to direct your wavering client to, or indeed if you are against the litigant in person and they won't listen to you, we can say, well, look, there's an objective piece of information. Beth Kirkland at Law for Life has done this piece of work, and she's redoing it in light of PAG 2. I've said on a number of occasions when I've spoken publicly about pensions, and I will say so again, it's so good that if the Pension Advisory Group report and the survival guide were both in the water and they were both drowning, I'd probably dive in and save the survival guide because it's just got such ability to reach out and help people beyond purely the lawyers. It's a tremendous piece of work, and I highly recommend that people download it and have it accessible.
And encourage their clients as far as they can to look at it, read it.
I think I would endorse what Rhys has just said. And I think, Rhys, I'm correct in saying that the new revised version is coming out in around May time, hopefully, assuming it gets all its approvals.
Yeah.
It lays on much more thickly the importance of taking pensions into account and the fact that they can't just be ring-fenced by husbands who think that that's their entitlement and they're not going to share it with anyone. It really does make it clear that the law requires it to be looked at just the same as any other asset. And so if you do have those cases as lawyers or as litigants, if you have those cases and you just want something to stick under the nose of the husband, and again, it's usually the husband, but not always, that is the perfect document to use.
Before we close, can I just say a couple of words about Hilary, please? because Hillary is about to retire herself. And she really has made the most monumental contribution to family law. She's been chipping away at pensions on divorce for the best part of 15 years now. Most of that, the overwhelming amount of that, has been on a pro bono basis. I cannot think of someone who has been so quietly consequential as Hillary has been in changing the axis around which people understand and around which they argue about these things in court. And she's very diffident, and she doesn't make a noise about these things. But for Hillary, none of this would have happened. And I've had a ringside seat for many years, seeing the quiet determination, and if you will forgive me for saying, bloody mindedness, to see things through to a conclusion that astonishes me. And you know, you have either as a PDF or on your desk a hard copy of the PAG 2 report, which is just sort of nicely presented there. But it took a ferocious amount of effort to get it done, and a huge amount of that is down to Hillary. Lots of people supported her, but without Hillary pulling us all together and also heaving it over the line in terms of the editing and the checking and the rechecking and the sorting it all out, it just wouldn't have happened. And so I just absolutely salute Hillary for everything she's done. It really has been the most remarkable thing. And, you know, I just want to say that.
Can I just say thank you very much for those wonderful words? I would also like to say it's been very much an interdisciplinary team work, and people have put in so much time and effort also without being paid for it. And that's, I think, what I take away from it. One of the best things is getting the experts and the lawyers together with the judges as well, and just thrashing things out so we get some help. Anyway, thank you for the comments.
Thank you three so much. I could listen to you all day. For our listeners, if you like what you have heard, please can you leave us a review?